Keeping your IT team sharp isn't optional. It's essential. CBT Nuggets delivers high-quality IT training led by real-world experts who know what teams actually need on systems teams will actually use. Whether it's staying current on cloud, networking, or security, CBT Nuggets makes training simple, effective, and scalable. No fluff, no wasted time, just smarter, faster IT teams. Thousands of companies trust CBT Nuggets, and yours can too. Go to cbtnuggets.com/solutions and start training today.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer. In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why Mylowe's Rewards members get a free Valspar paint or exterior stain sample to test your look to confidently refresh your space. Offer valid in-store only 87 to 820. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken in time of purchase. See associate for details. Rewards program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
There's one question in Brian Koberger's case that has a grip on anyone who's followed this story closely. One that doesn't fade even after the arrest, the conviction, and the life sentence. It's not about the timeline. It's not about the DNA or the knife sheath. It's about the things we haven't found. The K-bar knife. The clothing he wore that night. The things you'd expect to turn up in an investigation of this magnitude, but never did. And the longer they remain missing, the more the mind wanders to where they might be. And what that says about the man who took them out of that house and into the dark. In recent weeks, speculations picked up again, sparked in part by our own Robin Drake, who floated the possibility that Koberger could have had his own version of a BTK-style hidey hole or a buried stash cache of evidence, weapons, or trophies. It's not a stretch if you know your criminal history. BTK had them. Israel Keyes had them. Ted Bundy, in his own way, had them and held on to items that tethered him back to his crimes. For some offenders, returning to those items isn't nostalgia. It's part of the fantasy loop. And when you consider that Koberger's documented movements after the murders included detours to parks and wooded areas, it makes you wonder if that same loop was running in his head. And then there's the matter of the IDs, not in a glove box, as earlier reports had it, but inside a glove in a box at his parents' house. At least two IDs, both belonging to women who weren't among the Idaho Four. But according to the FBI property receipt, there weren't just two, there were 10. 10 IDs, 8 of which have never been publicly discussed. The official explanation, there isn't one, at least not yet. So we're left asking the obvious, who did they belong to? Why did he have them? And why are we only hearing about two? It's the intersection, the missing weapon, the buried or hidden trophies, and the unexplained cache of IDs that's worth slowing down for, because each of those elements on its own is troubling. Together, they might tell us more about what Brian Koberger was doing before the murders, what he kept after them, and what parts of the story are still buried, maybe literally, somewhere out there. So let's dig into it. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, joining us to dig into all of this. You've been very vocal about your own theory from the very beginning. You've said you never believed he ditched the knife or the clothing, given what we now know about his movements and what's turned up in searches. How plausible is it to you that Koberger had his own hidden cash? What do you make of these IDs?
You know, Tony, from the beginning, supposition on my part was that, and in part based on the shovel, was that certainly I believe he kept the bloody clothing, the K-bar knife. I never thought he threw it in the river or anything like that. And this is why. Mm-hmm. When you look at BTK, when you look at Ted Bundy, to return to the items that were used would be so stimulating. And of course, you know, this crime was a crime of sexual fantasy. Mm-hmm. We now know some of his searches, and what seemingly excited him was sex with bodies that were unconscious, sex with bodies that were completely compliant, and sex with people drunk, passed out. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that he would have kept the items as well. I think he would have used that shovel to dig, possibly. And that's why law enforcement took so many pains to try to find the dirt and try to match it up with what was on the shovel from all the different sites he stopped at, mm-hmm. according to his digital trail. So do I think he had an actual hidey hole that he dug before the murders? I think it could be possible, mm-hmm. But certainly I don't think he ditched anything. I think they're somewhere.
Yeah, that's the question. And would there be any incentive for Brian Koberger to reveal that information anymore today? Or do you think that might be something that is going to be locked away with him behind those bars?
I think someday, Tony, he's going to meet with somebody. This, I think, will fulfill the fantasy he's in now. Mm-hmm. He would love to be renowned, if you will. He would love to be a Ted Bundy or BTK. Actually, he's already reached that height, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody in true crime, certainly, that follows news, anyone that's paying attention knows his name and knows what happened to those mm-hmm. Idaho Four to some degree. And sure. So... what infamy for him, that he would have if books are written about him. But he's got to dangle some carrots out there. And one of those carrots, I think, is where is that K-bar knife and the clothing?
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating to see if we do ever get our hands on it. I'm wondering, I mean, they did find, we'll go to the IDs for a moment, the IDs in a glove, in a box of Koberger at his parents' home in Idaho. I know earlier reports, including here, we have been saying in a glove box, because that's really what it appeared when you look at it, but in a glove, in a box at his parents' home, doesn't necessarily change up the conversation all that much. He still had the IDs in a glove, in a box. So go from there. What does that tell us about him at all? And I'm wondering if there's going to be other things, other IDs hidden somewhere, other trophies. It seems odd that there's just the two of them there. And I'm wondering if there would be some things even more precious to him, if you would, that might be under the ground somewhere in one of these hidey holes, which dirt was still on his shovel from.
Well, the interesting part of those IDs, of course, are there are other females that he worked with far mm-hmm. back.
Yeah.
So, he would have confiscated those, Tony.
Yeah.
Right? He made the effort to have them. And I think that's part of the fantasy. And were they ever on his radar? I tell you, it seems like they were. He kept them. And that mm-hmm. was for a reason. What troubles me is if you look back at that search warrant return, it specifically says the number 10. 10 IDs in a glove in a box. Mm-hmm. And again, to put IDs in a glove, why? Other than you're hiding something mm-hmm. and in that box, right, that they found. So yeah. I always figured that they would be something interesting. But what about the other 8 IDs? And I think this goes back to our premise, right? He wanted to keep items that he could go back to and fantasize about.
Why are we only hearing about the 2 IDs? The information's coming out now. What would be the holdback on the other 8 being revealed? Because originally, yes, it did say 10. Are they saying that there's only two now? What's going on there?
Well, that's what bothers me, because there's a big disconnect. Mm-hmm. The FBI FB 597 clearly states 10 IDs. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't make any sense that only two are being discussed. So, you know, hopefully more will come out on that. I want to hear about the other eight.
Yeah, I certainly do too, because I mean, initially the early reporting had said that's not related to the King Road House. Obviously, the two that came out were not related to the King Road House. But I do wonder, I mean, there really hasn't been even any recognition that there are eight more. It's just simply we found two IDs. That seems to be the way it's being stated right now, correct?
That's correct. And I'm confused about that. At least what they're talking mm-hmm. about are the two IDs. But I specifically pulled that FD 597 up mm-hmm. and pretty much toward the top of that, you can see 10, you know, 10. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know,
it's
not two or 10. It's right there. This agent didn't have the best handwriting,
yeah.
but certainly you can see. It says 10 IDs. So yeah. What happened to the other eight? Why aren't they being discussed? And I always say, you know, in these cases like this, there's so much information that becomes fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
And now we are almost 3 years away. In November, it'll be 3 years. And Tony, sometimes the people that are being interviewed, for instance, that discuss those mm-hmm. two IDs, were those the only two IDs that they recall being significant? Because it's super significant,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion, that they were from his previous female coworkers, from as far back as, you know, when he was working at the school in Pennsylvania. So that's very significant. And maybe they didn't mention the others, but you should mention the others. And that paperwork will come out,
yeah,
I think.
I'm wondering about that. I mean, why would you not mention the others? And I guess perspective is another benefit that we have now, because it's all this time later. They may not have thought them to be significant at the time, but I think Koberger in possession of anybody's IDs is significant. To wonder, what was that all about? How did he have them? Why did he have them? Were they other ones his IDs? I guess don't technically know the answer to it. We know they were IDs. I highly doubt he had eight versions of his own ID. But yeah, why? And will that come out? Could that come out? Who needs to be shooken a little bit to get that information to fall from that tree?
Well, we still have so little, mm-hmm. you know, when you look at quote unquote terabytes of information, we're not seeing terabytes
no.
of information. We're seeing hundreds of pages, which is, you know,
not
so
much.
Little.
Yeah.
It's minuscule compared to everything that's out there. And then we're getting interviews about a lot of this. For instance, the two IDs, we haven't seen those IDs.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a document about those IDs. What we saw was an interview on the IDs. So it's kind of like you're just constantly having to go back and look and scrub, and there's so much to read. And some of it's just so routine.
Mm-hmm.
Documentary-wise, it doesn't give us anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then some is kind of interesting.
Yeah. No, it certainly would be fascinating to see who is on those ideas. And I think it's going to create nightmares for whoever's IDs that he actually had. But I bet there's a lot of people who are looking back going, hey, I lost my ID around that time when I was interacting with Koberger. And I bet they probably know who they are. That would be fascinating to find out, you know, who and when and why, if anybody even wants to speak up. I don't blame them for not wanting to put their hat in the ring of this case. If they do ever find this knife, this K-Bar knife, obviously he's in prison for the rest of his life. If it's found now, what sort of forensic value could it still have? Could there be anything out of them? I'm guessing this man is cleanly as he tried to be, that there wouldn't be a whole lot left on this knife. Although, who knows, if he thought nobody would find it, maybe there is for him to look back on in a dark, creepy way. Other than just the satisfaction of we found the knife, is there any value to retrieving it at this point?
There is always value, because even though I agree with you, he likely cleaned that thing inside and out. It's, you know, probably, devoid of any DNA or mm-hmm. biological information, but you never know. I've always said in that car that it would have been in the crevices or something found. And you know what? It wasn't, because he was that good. I mean, they talked about how he took the car apart and mm-hmm. put it back together. to make sure he cleaned, so no blood would have gotten in the creases, and probably prophylactically put down something. I tell you, that's what I find just so interesting about this case, along with a lot of other things. But Tony, the way he was able to really cover up this crime is unbelievable. His cleanup process, I mean, I'm sorry to give him accolades for this, but I just have to, because it was really good. And I've always said, I don't know if he would have been convicted. He would have been arrested, but I don't know if he would have been convicted without the DNA on that sheath, because he did such a great job covering his tracks.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Oh, Brian Koberger. Apparently, and I know this is going to disappoint a lot of you, he's not liking prison. It's not turning out to be a very good fit. End of the day, he's just not liking it. And there's a statement that's been made by the prison after some of these reports have been coming out that Brian's not having a great time there. And we'll read you that statement that was sent to News Nation here in just a few moments. But first, I want to go into this a little bit. I want to share the story of what's happening behind bars to Lil Bri, because I think that's going to be probably—should we make that his new jail nickname? Can those folks who are listening to us and watching us within prison, Lil Bri?
I like that. I like that a lot.
I think Lil Bri is a good one. I just want to bring up the message. Laura Engel reported this earlier today.
Poor baby.
So this is a statement from the Idaho Department of Correction. We are aware of Koberger's complaints about what he considers taunting. Incarcerated individuals commonly communicate with each other in prison. Brian Koberger is housed alone in his cell, and IDOC security staff maintain a safe and orderly environment for all individuals in our custody. So, kind of like we can neither confirm nor deny anything.
Right.
In that. Insiders in the prison, here's what I found out. Take it for what it's worth, allegations and all that. These prisoners were ready for this guy.
They were waiting. They were sitting there going, like Mr. Burns from The Simpsons, excellent, bring it on, baby.
And the staff was unaware until he got there. And then it seemed like there was a game plan in place for this guy. So,
anybody surprised by this?
Bravo!
I mean, he killed college students.
Bravo from anyone behind bars that is doing your job. I'm going to keep talking about you. And I bet there's a lot of canteens that are slowly getting filled out there right now. I would put some money on that.
Fuck around and find out. And Brian Koberger fucked around. He is about to find out, folks.
There's a lot more finding out that's going to be going on in the land of Brian. So it's the kind of dark you only find in a prison. Thick, stale, heavy. The silence, it feels staged. But Brian Koberger knows better. In the Idaho Maximum Security Institution, silence is never really silent, not for him anyway. Somewhere above his head, through a narrow steel grate, a sound slips in. Sometimes it's his name, dragged out like a taunt. Other times it's sharper, an insult, with the sting of a thrown rock. And sometimes it's nothing but a laugh, short, mocking, a sound you can't unhear once it's in your head. He's been here long enough to understand this isn't background noise now. It's deliberate, it's coordinated, and inmates on his tier know the way sound travels through those vents. They know where to stand and how to aim their voices. So they'll land in his cell like a whisper, straight to the ear. And they've turned that knowledge into a weapon. Former detectives who've walked those very blocks have said it's almost like a schedule. One man yells until his voice is tired, another takes over. The harassment comes in shifts, rolling from cell to cell, never letting him get comfortable. They want him
Ryan!
Agitated. Yeah. I can only imagine what creative things they're coming up with. Hey, here's an idea. If you guys got tablets, ChatGPT it. I bet you could find a bunch of ideas on how to get to someone like him. Trust me on that. They want him restless. And by all accounts, it is working. Before this, in pre-trial lockup, Koberger had already shown signs of obsessive control. He washed his hands until they were raw. He took showers that lasted nearly an hour, allegedly. Who knew? Who knew you could take that long of a shower in jail or in prison? He was in jail before. I don't think I'd want to take an hour-long shower in prison. I think that'd be more of a, like, get in, get out. And I'm not saying that kind of get in, get out, like, get in, get out of the shower room before someone gets in and gets out of you. And be out.
So just a second here. I just moved into an apartment from a home, and I am required to pay for my water, which
like a grown
came from
up,
a married situation before, yep. And he kind of took care of the utilities. So I haven't honestly any apartment I've been in, like heat and water have been covered. So this is the first time I've ever had water as a utility I need to cover.
And
I've been very, very conservative with my showers, like 4 minutes in and out. Let's not run the dishwasher until that bastard's full. Washing clothes, it's got to be full. Like, and he's getting hour-long showers and I'm out here being a law-abiding citizen.
Well, I think you might be a little obsessive on the other end of this spectrum here.
You might be, but it's pissing me off. I would love to have taken like a 15-minute shower.
And you know what? You can. No one is stopping you. No one is stopping you.
Nobody's stopping me. The only one
stopping you is Stacy.
Well, I just don't want a huge bill at this point. And
you're not poor.
To hear that he can take an hour-long shower?
You're not poor.
No, I'm not.
You can afford a 15-minute shower at this point in life. Trust me. You only live once, Stacey. You can handle a 15-minute shower. I believe
in you.
I'm
healing. There are some things that have happened. I'm just working through them. We're getting there.
Heal it through a 15-minute shower. Make it 20.
All right.
Fuck. Do sing American Pie 4 times, the long version.
Okay.
There you go.
That's 32 minutes.
He took showers that lasted nearly an hour. He paced in his cell like he was measuring for a blueprint. Sleeping was thin then. Now, with voices warming through the walls at all hours, it's almost gone. I'm wondering about the other guys. They're directing it at him, so they're not all hearing it. I get it. So I was going to say, that torments everybody then, doesn't it? Not when you direct it right at Brian. Ingenious.
Yeah, they're going to get mad, be like, it's his fault that I'm going crazy.
Drive him nuts, friends. Drive him nuts. He's in what prison officials call long-term restrictive housing, solitary to the rest of us, 23 hours alone in a cement box, 1 hour in a cage yard under the open sky, also alone. Showers every other day. Meals passed through a slot. No touching anyone, no sitting across from another human without steel or glass between them. It's meant to keep them safe, to keep others from making him the next headline. But solitary doesn't block sound. And sound is the one thing his neighbors have mastered. The guards hear it, of course, but there's only so much they can do. In prison, words aren't a crime. A threat has to be credible, physical, imminent. And so the taunts pour in unchecked, leaving no bruises, no paperwork, just a steady erosion of peace. Of, if you want to call what he has mental stability, whatever that baseline is in Brian Koberger. This is as hard as it is the safe version of prison for him. Because in the other version, the one that could become real if policies change or cell space runs out, he'd be in general population. And that's a very different game. One they've probably already played multiple times over in their head, just like this one. And they already know the outcome. And guess what? You don't come out a winner, Brian.
Nope.
General population is a max security prison, is its own ecosystem. You eat with other inmates. You walk the yard. You work the jobs. Kitchen duty, laundry, cleaning, if you make it that far. You're in proximity to men who might smile one moment from, and then lunge at you the next. For someone with a case like Koberger's, four young students killed in their own home, it's like walking into a room where everyone's already read your life. And history tells us what happens to inmates like that. Let's go through that list, shall we? We'll start with Jeffrey Dahmer, convicted of crime so grotesque they reshaped the country's concept of evil. Didn't make it 2 years. He was beaten to death in a prison bathroom with a broomstick in broad daylight while cleaning alongside other inmates. Yes, the broomstick entered orifices, Brian.
Yes, it did. Multiple ones, if I recall correctly.
And he died. He luckily died. I'm going to guess maybe these guys might make you want to hold on to you a little bit longer. Or maybe you get to have this experience more than once. Lucky you. And then there's James Whitey Bulger, the feared Boston mob boss, lasted less than a day at USP Hazleton. Inmates armed with a padlock and a stock and a homemade shiv attacked him in his cell, beating him so severely he was nearly unrecognizable. His tongue was almost torn out.
Ugh.
Yeah, that would be nasty.
Oh.
Can you imagine if you lived through that, Brian?
No.
Oh.
Almost like what your victims went through.
That's not going to be good for commissary time. Yeah, I mean, I guess it would really kind of, I don't know, what do you do if your tongue's gone and you're still alive? How does that work? Huh?
Liquid?
Huh. I wonder if we'll find out. Don't take any of these things as ideas, anybody. I'm just reading history of things that have also happened to folks like Brian Koberger. Hugo Pinnell, a name whispered in California prisons for decades, spent 45 years in solitary confinement. The day he was released into the yard with other men, they swarmed him. And he was stabbed repeatedly and died where he fell. They were waiting for him to come out. This is the exciting stuff you have waiting for you when the price is right, Brian.
The wheel is spinning now, isn't
yeah.
it?
Beep. Beep, 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 beep. $1. Ho-ho! You get to go to the Showcase Showdown. Even Ruth Purceful, an Alcatraz inmate whose crimes made him a pariah amongst his own, was targeted endlessly until he broke, self-mutilating in an act so desperate it still makes seasoned prison historians grimace. These aren't isolated incidents. They're part of the culture. In prison, notoriety is a double-edged sword. It makes you famous, but it also makes you a target. And crimes against women and children, or crimes with a certain kind of public outrage attached, are at the very bottom of the inmate hierarchy. So, Brian, you're not going to the top anytime soon. You're not even going to enter the countdown at number 40. Casey Kasem's not going to count you down.
Nope.
But I guess, I'm going to guess there's a lot of other folks who are going to count you down. Men with nothing to lose will use someone like Koberger in many ways and as a way to earn instant respect from their peers. If Koberger were moved into general population, the danger would be immediate. Maybe not the first day, or maybe not the first week, but it would come. A little shove, blade in the yard, a weapon smuggled out of the metal shop. In prison, the best attacks are fast, decisive, and often over before guards can respond. The irony is, solitary, meant to protect him, could be the thing that unravels him mentally long before anyone else can even touch him. Extended isolation eats away at the mind. The habits he's clung to for control could spiral into compulsion more than they already are. Paranoia, more so than it already is, will set in. Without human interaction, small slights feel amplified. Threats loom larger. And if he deteriorates too much, prison officials might have to move him, not into general population, but into a mental health unit. That would mean sharing space with others, albeit in a somewhat controlled environment. But even there, the rules of prison hierarchy still apply, and notoriety still attracts attention. So the question becomes, which is the greater danger, staying locked away in a concrete box with nothing but voices through a vent to company, or being put in a setting where those voices now have hands, shivs, and opportunity? For now, Idaho seems committed to keeping him in isolation. They've seen what happens when other prisons gamble with high-profile transfers. No one wants to be the facility that failed to protect or control the most infamous inmate in their state. But the reality is, solitary space is finite, budgets are tight, policies shift. All it would take is an administrative decision, a bed shortage, or a calculated risk to trigger a move. And if that day comes, Koberger will walk into his space where the taunts are no longer echoes in the dark, but men standing in front of him, ready to collect a kind of currency you can only earn in blood. Until then, he lives in that strange purgatory between isolation and exposure. Every night, the same ritual plays out, voices through the vents, pacing, hand-washing, a body that can't rest because the mind won't stop listening. He knows he'll be back tomorrow night, and the next, and the next. The silence when it comes is almost worse, because in the gaps between the shouts, there's nothing left to hear but his own thoughts, and the knowledge that the control he once wielded over his life, his environment, and his image is gone forever. In here, he's not feared. He's not respected. He's prey. And whether the predators can reach him with their hands or only their voices, they've made one thing clear. Brian Koberger will never know peace again. Good job. Gold star.
Sometimes you get what you pay for, you know? Not one shred of my DNA feels any sort of pain for him.
No.
Not one. And I'm a compassionate, empathetic person, and I don't feel anything for this guy.
Yeah.
And I don't think he admitted to guilt just because he didn't feel he could win a trial. I think he did this 100%.
Yeah. Yeah, he did.
So you're not wired correctly, and you're going to get taken out. Is it right? No.
But it's going to happen. What's more, okay, if we're going to talk about humane here, though, for a second, if we're really talking about being humane, put him down. That's the death penalty. Because is this humane? Everything I just said, none of that's humane. It's insane. It's insane to like want to wish that on somebody. But it's Brian Koberger, so I'm wishing that on somebody, him. But this is the reality. That I mean, it's like we want to be humane. We're against the death. Well, it will take its course this way then. What's more humane?
It will.
I don't know what's more. What's more natural? Probably this.
It's going to be faster.
It will. Yeah, I've said that from the beginning, too. I said, if you want him to die, put him in prison.
Yeah. Yeah, because there would have been so many appeals and, you know, trying to get a stay of execution. And now this is just going to take care of itself. Yeah, the trash takes itself out sometimes.
It could take 20, 30 years for him to die. I mean, the families of the girls could be dead. I mean, you know, if Steve is in his 50s, it could be he'd be in his 80s when they finally took him out.
Yeah.
You know,
it could be tomorrow.
I'd be playing my odds with the prison, honestly. I get all the anger of Steve and I very much agree with him. But when you take a breath and you go, okay. This does make, if that was, those are my kids and I wanted this guy to die, this is how I would bet on it. I wouldn't bet on it with the justice system.
I agree.
So that's the latest on Brian. He's not liking prison. Shocker. Oh, shocker. Do they have vegetarian options in prison? Do they honor that? Yeah. They do.
I think they do. Yeah. I thought I read that somewhere.
Okay.
Boy, and I thought I was having trouble adjusting to my new living space. I guess I need to chill out.
I wonder if the vegetarian options are better than like the meat options. And I say meat in air quotes. Be interested. Anybody who's had this, tell me in the comments section on YouTube. I'm curious. If you were in prison, what's the best way to navigate the food situation? Yeah, curious in the comments section there.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
There's a reason the Koberger case keeps pulling us back in, even with the verdict in, even with him sitting behind bars for the rest of his life. Because the closer you look, the more you realize how much we still don't know, and maybe never will. The DNA on the knife sheath is the piece everyone points to, the single clean link the prosecution was prepared to carry into court. But everything else, the missing clothing, the K-bar knife itself, no digital trail connecting him directly to the victims, the kind of things you expect to find in an investigation like this, they're just not there. And that's not an accident. Now, we're heading directly from the Cellbred examiners, the people who cracked open his devices and sifted through them line by line. What they describe isn't just someone who wiped their phone. It's someone who cleaned as they went, searching something, deleting it, delete it again, and really delete it so it can't be brought back. But here's the thing about data. Some of it burrows too deep to be just swept away. Wi-Fi logs, for example, the kind that silently record where your device has connected or even just scanned nearby. And one of those network names, the Mad Greek. If you've been following this case from the beginning, you remember the swirl of rumors around that restaurant. Two of the victims worked there. A former employee claimed she'd seen Koberger inside. The owner denied remembering him. It fizzled out as one of those he said, she said threads until now. The Cellbright data says his phone was in range of that Wi-Fi at least once, maybe more. That doesn't prove he sat down and ate lunch, but it does plant him close enough to shake hands with the router. So now you've got a man who's surgically erasing his digital footprints, leaving behind just enough to hint at where he's been. You got an early eyewitness saying he ordered a vegetarian pizza. You've got an owner pushing back, and you've got a forensic artifact saying, in effect, the phone knew this place. It's a lot of smoke for a fire that supposedly never happened. Jennifer Coffendaff, a retired FBI special agent, joining us to discuss. Jennifer, you've worked cases where tiny details like this, half forgotten by humans but remembered by machines, end up changing the shape of the investigation. Given what we know about his cleanup habits and the Mad Greek connection, makes you wonder, what does that tell us about how he was moving in the weeks before the murders? Let's get into it.
Well, I think then you have to cross-reference who was working there at that time. Was Zanna working there? Was Maddie working there? Mm-hmm. And so they have the particular time frame that the Wi-Fi connected. And according to the report I saw, it was multiple times, mm-hmm. possibly.
Yeah.
That's what they said. So if that's the case, did they do their due diligence, which I can't imagine they wouldn't, and cross-reference that with when Zanna and Maddie were there? Or, you know, was Kaylee there eating? Mm-hmm. She wrote a beautiful review about the Mad Greek. Mm-hmm. And so could she have been spotted there? It's clear to me that he was around the Mad Greek, and it's very coincidental, but we haven't seen that report where somebody looks at the dates and where everybody was at that time to give us that piece of the puzzle.
That's a key piece to this, and I'm very curious about it. I'm also curious, I would imagine, credit card receipts, things of that nature. I'm going to guess the Mad Greek, I'm going to guess the investigators would have looked back through that. Would they have not to seen if he had eaten there at some point in time, if it had come up on anything? Otherwise, you would assume he'd have been paying in cash.
Right. According, and you summed it up well. One of the workers there very early on said, listen, he was there. Mm-hmm. And then the ownership was very clear and really dogmatic. Mm-hmm. I remember this really coming out strong that no, he wasn't there. But I think you could only say that if you had a credit card or a digital trail on a bank card. But if he paid in cash, you wouldn't have that. And we know that he switched from using his credit cards and went to cash. Mm-hmm. You know, that's already been discussed at different times, I guess, after the crime. Mm-hmm. But did it before the crime when he was at key locations where he would have been surveilling or looking or gawking, as I said, coveting.
Yeah.
Coveting these girls. And I think for anybody who says there was no trail found back to Maddie or Kaylee, you can say that, but the logic tells us there was. It's just he erased it and we can't find it. But shoot, this mad Greek, I want to see, surely they did the proper cross-reference with when they would have been there.
And with surveilling Koberger as well. Were Koberger surveilling them at the homes, as we've learned about that many, many times now. It wouldn't be, I think, insane to think that maybe he was also surveilling them outside of the restaurant as well, if that's what he really wanted to do. I mean, we're talking, this was a place on Main Street in Moscow, Idaho. There's other places nearby on this downtown. It's literally Main Street where one could somewhat blend in, whether they're just a parked car nearby or sitting on a bench or walking up and down Main Street and gazing in the window as he walks by. I mean, there's a lot of ways that this could have happened, or it was part of the surveil and not necessarily him showing up for lunch. Although we do have that one person who says they served him a veggie pizza or a vegetarian pizza, which is a pretty specific thing to say that you believe somebody ate if you're not sure if they went there or not to know their actual order.
Yeah, I agree. I always have believed he went there and ate or went there and saw them. Mm-hmm. And again, that was based in large part on that interview with a former restaurant worker, mm-hmm. and the fact that he was a vegan and they served vegan food, mm-hmm. and the fact that Kaylee had a write-up about going to that restaurant, mm-hmm. And the fact that two of the victims worked there. It made a lot of sense to me that that could have been where he came upon them. Mm-hmm. It sounds like we won't know unless they cross-referenced those work shifts and Kaylee, the different times Kaylee was there, mm-hmm. if they cross-reference that, that might be something, but they don't seem to be talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this all takes resources, this all takes manpower, and the man is behind bars now. So, you know, how many, you know, actual law enforcement resources are actually looking into any of this anymore? I'm going to guess none.
None.
So this is all pretty much up to true crimers if they really want to find out the answers. And other than just getting the answers, I don't know that it changes a whole lot. Maybe it helps put some pieces together, you know, for the family of understanding his actions. But does it really matter at this point? I don't know the answer to that. But the curiosity, I'm sure, will always linger. I would assume we figure out the answers to this stuff without having to ever go back and ask Brian Koberger. Because then that kind of takes his spotlight away a little bit. Like, huh, we figured it out. Sorry, we don't need your feedback. We already figured it out on this end. But there were still certainly be questions there about it. What do you take out of the police scanner listening where he pulled up the streaming of it the night of the murders itself? This seems a little old school to me, of listening to the police scanner. And what is it exactly going to tell him if he's listening to it before the actual murders, not necessarily after, to see when they arrive and go into the scene?
Well, the reason it's so critical is it's going to tell him where they're at.
Sure.
Hi, we're responding here, we're responding there, mm-hmm. we're 10-8, we're 10-7, we're, you know, in other words, in service, out of service, mm-hmm. What they're responding to. So I think it's a real critical piece that I would want to know if I was committing a crime. I would be monitoring the scanner. And, you know, the Moscow Police Department, I would believe, do not have encrypted radios. Mm-hmm. So communication by the FBI, our radios are encrypted. You cannot scan them. Mm-hmm. They do not come up on a scanner, and the codes are changed. You have to do these code changes all the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're impenetrable. But no, the Moscow ones aren't impenetrable. And so I would have wanted to know that. Where are the units?
But what is the thought process there? Because by the time he gets there and he commits the crime, is he, how long do I have to get away? I mean, by that point, the activity will have changed as far as what's going on out there in the ether of Moscow, Idaho. And it's not that big of a town. So it's not like, oh, great, they're on the south side of Chicago. I'm on the north side. It's going to take an hour. It's Moscow. It'll take them 2 minutes to get from one side to the other. Does it, I don't know. It seemed, I mean, what would that have been valuable data for him, or is it just another? Was it just another piece of data for a man whose brain just fed and ran on raw data?
Personally, I think it was brilliant, and I would have wanted to know that. Mm-hmm. I would have wanted to know. Okay, they're at a big fight, and okay, all the units have responded, or this or that. I want to know how many are even on duty at 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, that's the witching hour,
yeah,
right? I mean, you're talking, everybody is done partying. People are not getting up yet and driving yet for their shifts, mm-hmm, mostly, you know, 6 a.m. shifts, right? That is sure, between 3 and 5, and he knew that. He mm-hmm knew that's when everybody, things should be pretty darn quiet. Mm-hmm. And so I think he just wanted to know. I bet he knew exactly how many units, as you said,
yeah,
it's a very small department. And yeah, now you know, wow, there's only two units here at all.
Well,
and they're having coffee. And they're 10-7.
And add that to the mix of he didn't know what he was walking into. So was the thought process at that moment in time, I'm going to go after one person, and what if somebody else is there in the house and they call 911? Is that what the thought is of if the police do get notified of my presence, here's my window to get out. And then he goes in the place and he discovers, you know, he ends up killing four people unexpectedly. That seems to throw a little wrench in the plan of whatever data the police scanner radio would have given you.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's never foolproof, mm-hmm, but in any operation, and I'll just call this an operation,
yeah,
that he was running there, data, any and all data can be useful. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to look for it all.
Yeah.
That's how I see it. There's, you can, you know, the more data, the better. And if you find some unuseful and other useful, that's fine, mm-hmm, but at least you have it. And as you said, listen, this was a guy who always wanted to be an officer. I consider that he was running this like a special op. Mm-hmm. You know, he planned for it. He had every base covered. And this would be one of the bases, in my view, you would want to have covered if you were going to do something like this. And it's outside of the box of what most mass murderers or fledgling serial killers would do.
Yeah. No.
Because he had that education. Mm-hmm. And he had that initiative to want to do that. So it makes a lot of sense to me, although I agree with you. Was it really helpful? Maybe not, mm-hmm, but maybe was.
What Jennifer just broke down makes it clear. This isn't just about whether he sat at a table in a restaurant. It's about how he operated, if the Cellbrite logs are right, and if his phone reached out to the Mad Greek's Wi-Fi more than once. That is not random. That's proximity. That's time spent in the physical orbit of two of the victims. And when you lay that over his own surveillance of their home, it stops looking like coincidence and it starts looking like a pattern. And what do we know about patterns? If you watch this show or watch true crime, they mean something. But it's also about the way those traces survived. He wasn't deliberate in his digital hygiene, search, delete, purge. Rather, he was deliberate in his digital hygiene of search, delete, purge. Yet some things, no matter how deliberate you are and how good your digital hygiene is, you just can't get out. Some things can't be fully erased without nuking the whole device, Wi-Fi records, system logs, the deep, stubborn roots of a phone's memory. Those are the bits investigators can still dig out years later. And if a casual coffee shop hotspot can survive his cleanup, what else might still be lurking in the shadows of his data? Then there's the human side, the conflicting accounts, a former worker swearing she remembers him right down to the order, and the owner adamant that he was never there. Both could be telling the truth, from where they stand. Memory is subjective. Data is not. But even data needs context. Without cross-referencing those logs against work schedules, receipts, and other sightings, we're left with possibilities, not certainties. And as Jennifer pointed out, that kind of cross-checking takes resources. Resources that may not be spent now that the man is already locked up. That's where this case lives on. In a space between what we can prove and what still gnaws at the edges. We may never get the tidy answers, and maybe the families will decide they don't need them. But these fragments, the IDs in a glove, the missing knife, the Wi-Fi log from a little Main Street restaurant are more than trivia. They're pieces of a map he drew in the weeks and months before that night. And that's why we keep coming back to them, because every so often a case like this isn't about the big cinematic evidence. It's about the crumbs he didn't mean to drop. The ones too small to notice at the time, but too stubborn to disappear. Those are the pieces that someday might tell us the rest of the story. Let us know your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. Or press subscribe wherever you're downloading us. Or do both. And press subscribe if you're listening to us on the podcast platforms. And do leave your thoughts in the comment section, like I said, on YouTube. We do greatly appreciate that. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now. And don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.